Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And you all know, because I've been saying it for years, love letters are your truth put to paper in a loving and compassionate way. Any memory or feeling you have that you care to share, why not do it? Stamp it and mail it and make somebody else's life richer. And you might be amazed at the depth of the joy they bring others. Today's guest is Mark Bovee, and I met Mark recently. And Mark, all I really know is that you're an actor, but I thought a producer also.
Yes.
So see, you're giggling, so you get to start.
A little bit of everything.
You tell us what it is you do first, and then we're going to get to who you are in there.
Okay. Mark Bovee is a very complex and complicated man.
Such a wonderful spirit, the way, because we just met for the first time today, and we had emailed and Facebook, and I felt like we had become really good friends.
And I think those energies are eternal anyway.
I think so.
I think that it's that kind of reconnecting to, I remember years ago someone had said, oh, it's like a past life experience. I was like, oh my God, what does that mean? And not to get off topic, but I grew up in a very small town, and my parents...
That's right on topic.
My parents separated when I was 13. My mom is...
Was that awful for you, or...?
It was unusual because I was 13, and I went from being an innocent 13-year-old child to essentially my mother's husband in a way, trying to keep an eye on my little brother who was 2 years younger and try and make sense of this deck of cards that had been reshuffled. My dad was a violent and abusive man, and... that's Elijah arriving right on time for Passover, everybody.
For those who couldn't see this, the door just slammed for some reason. Go ahead.
It was magical.
Yes.
Anyway, so it was unusual, and as I've come to realize over the years, taking an inventory of my life as I have, that it was really kind of great because I got other paternal images in my life, other father figures that innocently were in that new deck of cards that was being shuffled on that day that mom
came. Were those family friends? Or?
No, they were a very diverse group of men. One of them was my platoon sergeant from my Army Reserve days. He and his wife, Gail. Sergeant Babcock has gone to heaven, so I now only have Gail to
call.
Well,
can you just take a couple of slower steps as to you went from being 13 to in the Army?
Well, I graduated high school.
But, I mean, life went on more or less normally for...
Well, you know, it was unusual. I mean, my mom had reconnected with a childhood friend, and he kind of fell into that same category of man who was... who found refuge in alcohol, and it made him abusive and all that.
Okay.
So it's kind of an unusual dynamic for my mom to, when I look at her life and how she's gone through such painful experiences, that she continues to revisit them. And it, you know,
because
now,
that's who she knows.
Right.
How to be,
that's
she knows
her comfort zone. And now that she's gotten older, I'm starting to see my mom kind of become her own self and kind of step out of that. She now has a wonderful man in her life who treats her with dignity and doesn't call her filthy names and holds the door open for her.
Cry.
And it's absolutely beautiful.
How old were you when you joined the Army?
I was 23. Oddly, I had
graduated. A little older than
I was. A little older than 18. Yeah, I graduated high school in 1981 and moved to New York City the next day. So there was a bit of a culture shock.
A brave thing to do.
Well, my senior year in high school, my one big career goal was to be a movie theater manager in New York City for Lowe's Theaters, and that was it. No college, no Dartmouth, no Yale. I just wanted to be a movie theater manager.
How lovely to have a goal.
I know, right? There's at least some design acknowledgement of that. So, and then from 1981 to 85, I moved between New York City and Boston. My two favorite cities on the East Coast. And then on January 6, 1986, I moved to L.A. And I didn't know how long my run would be here. I'd come to visit once before. I had a friend who had worked on the movie Top Gun, so I got to go on the set. And I think that was probably when the hook got even deeper.
For the Army? For the movies.
For the movies,
yes, okay.
My mom was very disappointed that I was moving so far away.
I don't blame her.
And then in early 1987, after watching Heartbreak Ridge, the Clint Eastwood movie, at the Manchinese Twin, which is now gone, I was inspired, and I said to myself, you know what? I'm 23 years old. If I don't do this now, I may not ever have this chance to serve my country. And I was probably the only, up to that point, the first real adult decision I had made by myself without mm-hmm. running it past my mom for, you know, getting her input. And she was very upset and very disappointed in me for making that decision because my brother had served in the Marine Corps and had over years developed a brain tumor. And my mom always felt that there was some sort of liability that the government had done something that we don't know. But my brother's in heaven now, and my mom is had to say goodbye to her first son. It was a painful experience, and I can remember the Christmas Eve that my mom called and said that it was over and Kenny was gone.
Oh, that's awful. That's
it was a sad day, but oddly, I didn't feel that pain because my brother had gone from being a very tall man, 6'5", you know, guy. And in the last years of his life with the chemo and all the treatments, he'd lost a lot of weight and he'd had some procedures and over that time had lost a considerable amount of his vocabulary. And when he was no longer in that pain, I realized that release had occurred and it wasn't... So
what was Army like for you at that in that year? Where did you go?
I was 23. It was Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. It was April 15th, tax day, was the day that we left on a lovely American Airlines flight to Fort Leonard, to St. Louis, where the bus met us. And then we went from there to St. George or something. It's out in the country, out in the beautiful Ozark Mountains. It was a beautiful place. I can remember some days of basic training like they were yesterday.
What stands out?
I remember on Memorial Day 1987, we did our 10-mile road march out to the middle of the woods. And I've often wondered to myself, you know, on Memorial Day, every Memorial Day, I think, wouldn't it be kind of cool to have that sort of renaissance and do a 10 or 15-mile march to the city and get people to raise, you know, awareness for veterans' issues and all that?
So you're smiling. See, this is why I need a television moment so people can see that beautiful face and smile. My goodness. But you're smiling. Which leads me to believe that these were good days for you.
They were, of course, with all the challenges that would come from that sort of physical challenge. I won't make light of the fact it's difficult. There are some very challenging physical and emotional things that occurred during that process.
That doesn't mean there weren't good times.
No, they weren't good. Oh, absolutely. And oddly... because I was always able to think to myself, well, the other guy to the left, the other guy to the right is going through the same exact experience I am. The stuff that they're spraying in the air that makes us cough and hack is no less strong for them than it is for me. The mountain that we're climbing is not any higher for them than it is for me. And we're going to get through this together. And
so you got to feel not put upon.
I just felt like part of the mechanism.
Okay.
And I think it's an important part of our cultural identity about being a part of that chain of my grandfather had been, my father was in the Seavies, my brothers had been in the Marine Corps. And to me, it was important to be a part of that. And I could not ask someone else to make that ultimate sacrifice if I myself had not been willing to make it. So
good for you.
It was important.
Did you stay in this country your whole tour of duty?
Yeah, I was in the reserves and National Guard. So, the first part was in the Army Reserve, and our unit was first in South El Monte and then Corona. And I drove.
Do you have friendships still from the Army?
I do, actually.
Oh, that's
I
so nice.
Certainly do. And that was 1987. And I've actually seen some of my friends go to other worlds from that time. And but there's a special brotherhood. I'm now involved with an organization called the GI Film Group. And GI Film Festival. We just had a big event in Washington, D.C.
Okay, so talk about your switch to acting and producing and things you do. How did you find your way into that?
Well, having had been a movie theater manager.
Oh, so you actually did get to realize that.
I did.
You didn't say that.
I did.
Oh, good. Okay.
And I was usually flagship locations in Boston, and then when I moved to L.A.
Oh, that's wonderful, yes.
There was the Cinerama Dome was a theater I managed. The Paramount, which is now the Al Capitan, was another theater that I got the privilege of operating. And it was always very special because for me there was that ribbon of consciousness that kind of I had found in my soul that made this a special thing. It wasn't just about counting the money and opening the doors.
Well, it's a real self-definition. That's who you are.
And showman is one of those labels that I will gladly have other people acknowledge me by.
Okay.
I personally only prefer Earthling because that's the only label that I'm comfortable with. But if other people were to assess Showman, I would be okay with that. So, so the festival.
Your involvement in making movies.
Yes. In 1990, I left the theater business and started working in distribution at Universal Pictures.
So you got yourself a job.
Yes, a real job that didn't involve weekends and holidays and Saturdays and Sundays.
Okay.
And something that I could start Monday morning at 8 o'clock and finish on Thursday at 5 o'clock.
So you don't seem to have had these days of just being lost and no job. And you seem like a very directed, a beautifully self-directed man. I mean, you know.
There's a time, though, that I think there was a lot of my life that professionally I kind of was telling someone the other day that I think sometimes the last decade of my life was more of a coffin because I didn't really realize that someone was shoveling the dirt on top of top of where I was. But
so
it was
talk about that.
Going. So I had been a part of a large media company for many years of my life, and it was a beautiful experience. I made a lot of friends. I developed an identity, and people realized that I was committed and honest and creative and courageous and all those things that I think people look for in friendships, both professionally and interpersonally. And I started to sense a shift in that frequency where I spent my day. And there were some really ugly moments of some of the most atrocious behaviors.
Towards you?
Towards me.
Oh.
And one day I had asked that something be done about it. And it was addressed, but I was told that there had been some issues about my judgment and my personal behavior that had caused me to be considered for promotion with the company. And I said, my, the timing on this is rather curious. It almost seems to me as if this is a reprisal or a retaliation for my asking for someone to actually deal with this awkward interpersonal dynamic. And I figured that if someone was going to assess me with having, as they called it in the actual company document, a behavioral issue, I thought I would seek medical attention immediately and saw my physician. And began.
How does that relate, if I may ask, into seeking medical attention?
I just felt broken.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And not that I've ever been without hope, but it almost felt hopeless to have committed such a large part of one's professional life to a purpose and a cause and an identity and a mechanism that literally wanted to receive the bounty and the lion's share of one's hard work. But when it came time to deal with, you know, the interpersonal dynamics, there was no support.
So you're talking about emotional support.
Correct.
Oh, that's
correct.
Good for you. Okay.
Correct. And I think that sometimes.
See, even that is like beautifully self-directed. You knew where you need to.
You know, in hindsight.
I'm so impressed with all this.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you. So I started talking to a wonderful healer, a gentleman who I have seen the last 5 years of my life. And as I've said many times, I think the one of the great dynamics that faces this nation is our mental health. You don't have to go too far inside the LA Times or the North Carolinian to see the problems of the carnage and the man being unkind to each other. Yet everybody celebrates Christmas and Easter, yet when it comes time to actually living the life that their Savior, our Savior, the Savior has offered, sometimes it gets lost.
They forget the reason for the season.
Right.
Yes.
And that the season isn't just December 25th. It should technically be the year long. It was so great. I called my mom on the 4th of July, and I said, so what did you do today? She says, oh, I've been watching A Christmas Story all day long.
Aww.
And my mom, she always used to dig the Christmas records out in August and June. Yes. And I asked her, why do you do that? She says, well, I think Christmas should be every day of the year. And it's a beautiful sentiment, and it'd be great.
And that she acts on it.
I know, right?
It's past beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, how did this segue into the GI Film Festival?
Well,
what is that?
I am my commitment to serving my country was interrupted by an illness, and I always felt kind of a sense of brokenness about that it was an illness at the time that was very, very popular in terms of, you know, a large body count, and at the moment is not. So we take pills and we're fine. But there was always this sense of what if, coulda, shoulda, woulda, maybe this shouldn't. And we can't really live in that world because it's not a healthy place to be.
Right.
But I was at the festival came to LA 2 years ago, and I was invited to participate on a panel and talk about film distribution. And it was wonderful. It was a two-hour program. Steve Dunning, who is a part of the Got Your Six campaign, which is a military campaign for veterans in the entertainment business, Steve put together this amazing program. And Steve and I have become good friends since. And I went back. The event was at the Walt Disney Studios. And I talked to the founder and his wife, and they said, I said, listen, you've got this amazing legacy, this amazing library. It seems to me there's something valuable here that you could create a national platform or a global platform. And so they really liked the idea, and so they flew me out last year to see the event in D.C. And it's really a wonderful night. This year there was this wonderful film, not to get off track. But
no, there's no such thing as getting off track, because this is for you to tell us about
this
you.
Wonderful film called Remembering the Fallen, and it's a movie. It's not silent. It's just it has no dialogue. It's about a Frenchman and his son and daughter who are taking him to the cemetery to visit somebody, but we don't really know who. And then we go back in time. There's this little leaf that kind of floats through the scene to kind of take us back and forth. And it's a scene about these two men on the battlefield, just two, who take comfort under a tree. And they're both clearly very badly injured, but connect and realize that they're brothers, despite the difference in their uniforms. Mm-hmm. And the movie ends at the cemetery with the Frenchman looking down at his friend who's now in the grave. And there's this picture of them when they were younger. And it's hard to imagine sitting in Washington, D.C., in the Canadian embassy, surrounded by people in uniform and these really tough, you know, burly men, and to sit and hear the...
Yes, you're going to hear mine.
Coming from behind you. And I almost wanted to turn around and look and see who it was. But the auditorium was full of that. And to me, there's something very therapeutic about that sanctuary experience that happens when we can all connect and share that experience in light and sound. And I think that therapeutic-wise, I think curiosity-wise, I think films are a great way to kind of make the awareness greater.
Sure.
Rather juvenile use of words there, but that's okay.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I think it was a rather juvenile use of words there. I'm rather more articulate than that. But.
No. That was said it just fine. And the reach of these films, I mean, there is really not much that's more powerful because of what you can reach people with.
Correct.
And of course, you know, you're seeing it in the privacy of your own little body. I mean, you're by yourself watching these things.
Yes.
You can react how you react. You're not obligated to play to anybody like at a party or a game.
Correct.
It's a private thing, even if you're sitting in a room full of people, hence the from the audience. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. And that's
perfect how you described it.
We screened at a client, it is a film about World War II that we'd taken to West Point. And it was, I'd never been to West Point, and to be there as someone who was bringing something to the cadets was really very powerful for me. And to this day, I still get text messages from some of the cadets saying, hey, we're going to be in LA. Do you want to do this? You want to do that?
Oh, nice.
And it was a wonderful, it just goes back to the brotherhood dynamic. And I think that, you know, aside from maybe the military or, you know, the correctional institutions, that sense of brotherhood is something that really, if we could just find a way to study that and
bottle it
and bottle it or put it in pills that people, when they feel that they can't connect to the person sitting next to them or that lack of empathy, but sometimes from the most ugliest of places. And back in 1998, I had the experience of, well, I was a big party guy. Oof. And I've told this story 1,000 times, and I'm not uncomfortable sharing it with the world, but I had a wonderful friendship with this wonderful woman whose birthday was on Sunday. She's since gone to heaven, but her name was Terry Garcia. And Terry was a spinal column patient, and she lived the years that I remember her in a wheelchair. And we would go places, and she'd always call me up, Bovi, come on over, and this is what our adventure. She had it all planned out because she had all the time. And she was the kindest, most sweetest person that lived life more from her wheelchair than a lot of people that I know live their life without that added platform. And so one night, it was New Year's Eve 1999, so it was going into 2000, and I had taken some beers to some gentlemen who were sitting underneath the Second Street Bridge in Boyle Heights. And it was the most amazing experience because I just wanted to learn about them. I will admit I was feeling no pain, so I went down, and these guys are standing next to the burning trash can, and they asked me 1,000 questions. And one of the guys says to me, "You know, we could kill you." And I looked at the guy and said, "But you're not." And they didn't. And it was one of those moments that I don't advocate this for everybody, but it was my moment. And it was my moment of discovering that I'm a powerful person.
Oh, yes. And, I could see that.
And what I say about myself is who I am. And sometimes I fall prey to the doubt, as a lot of people do. But I think for the most part, these last months, to jump back a little bit, on July 17th, 2013, not knowing that it was the 58th anniversary of Disneyland, one of my favorite places to visit, I drove away from this rather dysfunctional, hurtful dynamic where I had worked for many years. I had never been in that place in my entire life. I had always been focused on what I was doing, and I didn't allow my profession to define who I was, but it was a part of it. And all of a sudden, after all these years, it was done. I had no idea the adventures that would come from that single choice to change direction.
Now, what was the direction that you...
I'd originally left to start a universally accessible media business to...
Oh, and that is what you do now, right?
We do that. That's one of the services that I connect clients to that would like to make their television and film accessible to the blind, deaf, and hard of hearing.
Ah, I see. Okay.
And we even have we're working on a radio platform with CJ Jones, who is a deaf celebrity, and giving him his own radio platform so that he can start to, you know, using the cameras in the studio and online captioning to provide that cultural identity to, or that cultural opportunity to a culture that's never really had radio. We're coming up on the second anniversary in a couple days. And I'm very excited because there's so much going on. I've never felt more engaged and more dignity professionally than I have by that simple act of just saying, you know, it's time for me to go.
You know, it sounds like you have just come to meet yourself around the corner.
Ooh.
And take off and do what you have been kind of talking about this whole time I've been listening to you, which is, how do I connect the world in a positive feeling? You talk about brotherhood. You talk about, yes. Oh, that makes such sense that that's what
you're
doing.
And what a beautiful illusion of coming around the corner and then connecting it back to me. Because I think ultimately that's the power.
That's amazing. Oh, I'm glad. Oh, my goodness. You're very clear. I could listen to you for so long. You were such an angel in this world.
Oh, hey. My pleasure.
My goodness. I have a question.
Yes.
And you were talking about, well, you talked about a couple of things that make me want to ask you this, because I am about love letters and the power of written expression of affection, mail to people. Mm-hmm. Have you ever written letters to people?
Yes, I have.
Can you say who, or just, I mean, not names necessarily, but what kinds?
There was... a person in my past who had hurt and betrayed myself.
Oh,
my mother. Oh. And it was a very powerful hurt that I felt at some point I needed to forgive. And I think that societally, I think forgiveness is something that has a really weird identity.
Well, I was just talking to somebody about this, yes, because too many people don't know really what that means and how to do it. So how did you do it?
It took me the acknowledgement of sitting with the therapist and saying, you know what, I'm going to write a letter to forgive this person.
Good for you.
And they said, well, I would love to read it. I said, good. Next session, I'll come back and we'll read it. And so I drafted something, and I will admit I had a coworker that I trusted with my life.
Oh, that's fine.
She always would give me an honest feedback, and she says, I love it. This is the best letter I've ever read in my life. I said, okay, good. So the next Saturday, I went and read it to the doctor, and I signed my name, and I folded it and put it in the envelope and put the stamp on it. Actually, I peeled it off and put the stamp on it. And
did you mail it?
I dropped it in the mail.
Any results?
And a couple of weeks later, there was a written letter from this person who acknowledged receipt of my letter and says that it looks like I turned out pretty well. There was no explanation. There was no apology. I didn't write for those things.
Oh, see, now you're making exactly the point that I like to make. Is when you send a love letter to somebody, and forgiveness is a big kind of love letter, what do you get to expect in return? Nothing. It's a gift. You've done your part.
It's like love.
Yes. Sometimes when a relationship has been really horrible, I wish I could see yours or hear it, but we don't have time, and I don't know if you even wanted to share it, but sometimes when a relationship is really bad, you have to sift through the garbage and the pain for the two nuggets of gold that you might find and make that your letter. You come up with something really beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you did that.
Yeah. It was huge. It was a powerful moment in my life.
For you.
Yes.
Yes. And isn't that another benefit of writing a love letter?
Yeah.
You get to bathe in your own strength because in the world of love letters, you're the boss.
Exactly. Exactly. So,
would you?
Good.
Well, now your mother's still here.
Yes.
Have you ever written to her?
My mom is she loves to write.
Mm-hmm.
communication with my mom is a very interesting experience. I used to send emails, and then I used to forward when people would say, "Oh my God, you're amazing." I'd always reply and copy my mother and say, "My mom did a wonderful job, didn't she?" Then the other person would reply, "Oh, is this your mom? How nice to meet you." And then it would stop.
But see, you've just touched on something else really important. I love the way you keep doing that. Your instincts are wonderful. That's what parents want to know, that they did something right.
Mm-hmm.
They can die in peace. I'm telling you, this is as a parent. You want to know that you did something right.
Right.
And that your children know it, i.e. they paid attention. Mm-hmm. What if you were to just write your mother some kind of a letter, just... I don't know, thanking her for the things that she did that you remember liking.
You know, outside of Mother's Day, that sounds like a wonderful idea.
I will tell you that I wrote one to my mother years ago, and my mother, who was sharp until the day she died, she was 96, I wrote it maybe when she was 90-ish, and every time I went to visit, she would say to me, "You know, I just read that letter that you sent me." Now, you're laughing, and on the face of it, it might look like she's losing it and repeating herself. No, the truth is she read it again and again, and every time she read it, it was like a new affirmation of what she did right. Oh, you'll feel so good doing that.
And I think if I include a link to a certain podcast where she can...
Oh, yes, definitely. But I'm talking about writing it in your own handwriting.
Oh, handwriting, okay.
And you put it in a stamp, you said, and you stick it in the... And then she'll read it, and you won't be
there
to...
Do they still have those things?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you don't lick stamps anymore.
No, you peel.
Oh,
yeah.
But they have gorgeous ones.
I remember
that
taste.
I'm so glad you asked me to.
That taste was so good.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
And the taste of the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
So the benefit of that was you were doing something physical. You were licking that thing, and you were licking the stamp, and your DNA was all over that thing. They could clone you from one of those letters.
Oh, good to know.
Yes. Oh, thank you for talking to me about all this.
Oh,
everything you said was so interesting to me. I learned so much. There are whole worlds that I don't know about, and at GI Film Festival, for example.
Yes.
Okay, so someday will you come back and do another one?
I would love to. We could do a week together.
I would love to do a travelogue
with you.
That would be so nice. Oh, you're just a treat of a human being. I'm so glad we met.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for doing this with me. And before I say goodbye, I want to say, as I always do, if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, like Mother's Day, writing a love letter is a special occasion all by itself. And you know, you were talking about having Christmas all year long. You can have Mother's Day all year long.
Yeah.
You can have anything all year long. You don't need to wait for an occasion.
True.
Thank you for sharing that letter of forgiveness, too. I mean, the fact that you did it, that's huge. Okay, darling, I'm going to tell you goodbye. I'm going to tell my listeners goodbye. Talk to you later.
Thank you.